if in one of the sheets that we looked at last night that Paula got us started with, if she had put on that list, who had been, have you guessed who had been a bartender? You know, all of you could have come to me. Because I have been a bartender. And one day, I observed something that just made me furious. Just blew me away. I was just this far from reaching across the bar and grabbing this guy by his collar and slamming his head down on the bar and tell him, "Mister, why can't you listen to what your wife is saying to you?" Because that was what was going on at the bar in this restaurant I worked in, where the pain and the suffering that this woman was experiencing was being completely ignored by this know-it-all chauvinistic pig. And it just made me furious. Now, can you guess why it made me furious? This is going to be good. Yes? Exactly. I repeat it. She says, because you knew you were guilty of the same thing. That was 10 years ago. I started working in this seafood restaurant as a bartender. And, you know, bartenders are all psychologists. Because we hear a lot of things and experience a lot of people's lives because they get loosened up with the booze and they will talk to the bartender. Or you get to observe from a distance or even close up what people talk about, even though they don't know you're hearing or listening. In this instance, it was classic. Here was a woman who was troubled and obviously had wanted to have some time to talk with her husband. Okay, and he finally agreed. So here they are. Well, let's go out to Southfield Charlie's. That was the name of the restaurant. And we'll leave the kids at home, and you want to talk, this is where we'll go. Now, to give you an idea of where this bar was set up, the bar was in the middle of an eating area. And the bar was normally the waiting place for people who were waiting for tables. So you put your name in on the list, and when the table was ready, they would call you. But in the meantime, you can sit around the bar and make the company more money with overpriced drinks. That was the price margin, you know. So if you think that, well, let's go out to this romantic place, the restaurant business loves that. They love for you to spend money in the bar because it only costs about 20 cents to make an average no-name drink. But they will charge you $2.50. If you want a call brand, they're going to charge you even more. But if you're willing to pay that for aesthetics, fine. It's hard for me to do that. But here's the setting. We're going to go to this bar, and we're going to talk because you want to talk. So she's trying to express herself. She's becoming more frustrated. And he's discarding everything she says as unimportant. And what is it that you really want? I work hard. I give you these things. And you're always complaining, was the scenario. Anybody familiar with any of this? You ever see any of this anywhere? Have you ever been there? Okay. What was making me really upset initially was just what I was seeing. But in reflection, I thought about how I was. And that was part of Paula's exercise for us to find out how we are. What are our types? How do we generally function? Are you this type, that type, and so forth? Because knowing how you are will mean you will have better chance of refining oneself. Not changing somebody else. But the bottom line, the last thing I think Paula said this morning was that it will enable us to work on ourselves. Well, this guy couldn't see himself, but I could see him, and I saw me. I saw how it's easy to dismiss another person because they are impeding upon what it is that you want to do. You can go along thinking everything is just fine. But in the program we have for you today, it talks about the art of listening. This gentleman did not have it. If I had asked him, "Are you listening?" "Oh, yeah, I hear what she's saying." But hearing and listening are not the same thing. You may hear the words, but are you gaining on the communication that's being attempted? Scenario basically is the American way of life. You know, I'm working out here in the workaday world, the father says, you know, I'm fighting these dragons out here and slaying them. And I come home and you are dissatisfied. We've got two cars in the garage. We live in the suburbs. We've got 2.5 kids or whatever the case might be. There's money in the bank. We go on vacations. "What's your problem?" the man says. And I hope that you appreciate I'm talking generally from a male perspective, because that's what I am. And generally speaking, the men are the culprits. Why do I say that? If we were to go back, as Mr. Dart has done, did this morning, to the original marriage situation, and the point I was making this morning was that God created the man first because he was going to expect more out of him, because he was going to be the CEO of the family. You know what CEOs are responsible for. There's an owner. God is the owner. He puts in place a CEO called man, a male, and then he created the woman to be suitable for the man in a helping situation that was going to fabricate a family circumstance. So if the family falls apart, as it did in the garden, whose name did God call? Eve, who was the perpetrator of the sin? No, he called Adam. That's important. If we're going to fully understand and comprehend how things are supposed to work. So if I am heavy on the men, and ladies will appreciate that, it's because we are responsible. God holds us responsible on how things are going to work. And when it comes to communication, first of all, let me ask you this. What are the big three causes for the dissolution of marriages? Anybody want to help me? Yes?
Sex,
money. Well, money.
Children.
Nah. No, it's not children. Causes for divorce? Well, children do come as a result of this, so we will just put children in that. Oh, you got some real pins? Okay. Oh, thank you. Okay, sex, money. You've been married a while, haven't you? Communication. Okay. Sex, money, and communication. Now, which one of these is the number one? People, you're answering the answers too quickly. You're supposed to let them draw out a while. You say money. Who says sex? Yes? Well, okay. Communication is the number one reason that people are getting divorced these days. It may be communication about money and about sex. But this is the underlying, underpinning, cohesive element that makes marriage work. Or any relationship work. I hate the word communication myself, because I was so bad at it. But I'd like to use the word communion. Can I use that? Communion? What do I imply when I use the term communion? Anybody want to help me with that? Because it means the same thing as communication, but I like the word communion. Anybody want to help me with what am I saying when I talk about communing? Soul, I could identify with that. It's the soul thing. Yeah, that's right. It's a soul thing.
Can you call it a bonding?
Yes, Yes, it's a bonding thing. Now, they weren't even here today. How do they know all the answers? Okay, that's good. Communing. The Bible talks about communion, does it not? And it talks about communion in the context of the table of the Lord. And it talks about communion in that people are sharing something of themselves. And that the table of the Lord in communion is to bind us to Christ by the things that we do or the things we say. Communion. So the objective then of communication or communing with one another is to be cement to bind us together. To share something of ourselves that we ordinarily would not do. Charles Swindoll has written a book entitled Strike the Original Match. Subtitle, Rekindling or Preserving Your Marriage Fire. Mr. and Mrs. Dart aren't here, but Mr. Dart went to school with Chuck Swindoll. In fact, they graduated in the same graduation class of a school from Houston, Texas. Which is an amazing thing that two master teachers would come out of the same graduation class at a school in Houston at the same time. Chuck Swindoll is well known around the country. Mr. Dart is lesser known, but is not any lesser of a teacher. I can say that because he's not here now, you know, so I won't be lathering him up. He says something about marriage. He says there are four musts for marriages. They are severance, that is, a man should leave his father and mother, leave his father and mother, that's a severance. Permanence, a man shall cleave to his wife. Unity, and they shall become one flesh. And the fourth thing is intimacy. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. Mr. Dart went over some of that this morning, but the fourth area of intimacy is what I want to talk about. Because it is very difficult sometimes to be intimate. Oh, it's easy to have sex and to call that intimacy. It is intimacy. It is a form of intimacy. But to truly connect mind to mind, because actually that's where sex takes place, that's where it really happens, up here. And if there are impediments to the mind being clear and clean, the physical act of sex doesn't amount to very much. That's why Paul said, I would rather that you not connect with a whore because you are becoming one flesh with a whore. And that becoming one flesh in a sexual intimate relationship must be in marriage. So he condemned the other aspect of attempting to have intimacy with someone other than your husband or wife. Intimacy actually starts from the words you speak. And words, despite the little jingle we learn, do hurt. Sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Oh, really? Who can witness that that is true? Can I get a witness that that is true? Well, we all learned it. But words do hurt, and they drive down very deep, and as a result of it, it destroys intimacy, because it destroys the primary element of intimacy, trust. I can't trust you because if I trust you with this tender thing, you'll hurt it. And so walls are erected, barriers are erected, trouble starts, and you just can't get through. Marriage is an intimate relationship. In fact, it is the most intimate relationship one can have. Far more than a parent-child, far more than siblings, brothers or sisters, far more than good best friends. Because in those relationships, you cannot have the ultimate intimacy that does come through sex that God designed. He designed it for more reasons than simply procreation. It was an ability to express oneself and the in that intimate environment. The intimacy involves, this kind of intimacy in marriage, involves the blending together of thought, of plans, of hopes, dreams, and the most private of feelings. And if you don't trust the person, you don't share those things. You don't even know how to express your hurt when you don't trust. Because if I say this, I'm going to get hurt. And many times, as your outline has it, talking about the barriers of to communication, many times those barriers are so high, so wide, so deep. Oh, this is terrible. That you can't, remember the little song you learned when you were in the Baptist church? So high you can't get over it, so low you can't go under it, so wide you can't get around it. But there's a key, and there's a door that will allow you to get into it, and I think that key is communication. Well, sex is always around, so I guess I have to leave that there. In many marriages, a lack of communication, the tendency to blame others, and selfish attitudes make it difficult for husbands and wives to understand each other's feelings. And I gave you three things. The lack of communication, the tendency to blame others, thank you, and selfish attitudes are the impediments. But I want to deal with the communication situation, because that is quite severe. Thinking back on this particular couple that I described to you at the bar, now if he had been a wise man who understood his position that was God ordained, you know, I don't know what his religion was or how much he knew about the Bible or anything, but if he had understood it, if he had understood what Paul says about men loving your wives, he didn't say to the wives, love your husbands. You can't point to a scripture in the Bible where God ever told a woman to love her husband. He said, respect him, to reverence him. You ever thought about that? There was a natural tendency in the woman to love or to be husband-centered. Not so with the man. He was out there in the workday world beating up on the ground. So he commanded him to love his wife, even as Christ loved the church and gave himself to the church and so forth and so on from Ephesians 5. So if this man had understood that, he would have been able to look at his wife and say, there's something wrong here. There's some hurt here. I think I better listen. I better see what's really going on here, if it's important to me. But many times a man will think it's not important because it doesn't fit into the program. You know, those types we've been talking about. It doesn't fit into my calendar, my schedule of events. I had the feeling as I was watching him that he had set aside this little time. Okay, you want to talk? We'll go out to this crowded bar with all this noise and we're going to talk. Really? I mean, that was really great of you. Boy, that's really a peach of a deal. I mean, I got to sit here at this bar, she could have said, with these tears streaming down my face, and you're not listening to me. That is generally what happens many, many times. But here we are today seeking to enrich our marriages and to build upon the positive things that we have. So we can learn some things about the importance of talking and the importance of listening, because talking and listening go hand in hand. There was something written by a person named Carol Avery, who's a researcher, and she says, preconditioned on the sharing of feelings, intimacy requires consummate trust. Absolute trust. Because if I don't trust you, I'm not going to share my most intimate thoughts. I'm just not going to give you that and have you stomp all over them with hobnail boots. This woman was sharing her intimate thoughts, and this guy was crushing it. What's wrong with you? Why are you complaining? Why aren't you satisfied? I mean, I do everything for you. I sacrifice myself for you. Can't you understand that? Can't you be appreciative? Well, he missed a point. He missed a point the Proverbs talks about. If you turn to Proverbs 20 and verse 5, there's so many Proverbs we could have looked at about communication, but I'm only going to look at a few. Proverbs 20 and verse 5. It's talking about sharing of intimate thoughts. It says there, counsel in the heart of a man, and man, as we've learned, is the generic term. It could be male or female. Counsel in the heart of a man is as deep waters. My mother used to say, and it's a common saying, still waters run deep. But the man or the person of discernment, that is wisdom, is one that will draw it up. Now that is a terrific saying, one that must be exercised if one is to build the kind of intimacy that belongs within a relationship, and especially in marriage. Counsel in the heart of a man is as deep waters. It's down there. It's in there. But a person of discernment is one that will draw it out. In the scenario I painted to you with the couple I talked about, if he could have just changed the setting, you know, it's too noisy here, honey. You really want to talk, and I want to give you my undivided attention. Maybe we should go to someplace quieter. You know, let's go someplace where I can really hear what you're saying and really tune into your words. Because it says a person of discernment will draw out those feelings where there is trust. Marriage mates must be discerning and draw up the thoughts deep down in their spouses' hearts. Because unless you know, you can't act, because you cannot read minds. There's nobody who can read somebody's mind. And so an environment has to be created whereby that intimacy can go on, where this proverb, in fact, can be utilized. A derivative or a byproduct, then, of communication, of communing together, is trust. And where there is trust, one can draw out those thoughts about anything. It may be, you know, if you're both sports fans and you like the Dallas Cowboys, you may want to talk about the Leon Lett thing. Huh. Intimately. You know, where you really don't think about a divorce because you disagree. I mean, it seems like a trivial thing, but people do get mad over things like that. One of the finest couples I've ever known, they've been married now probably about 45 years, and they live in the city of Detroit. He said to me one time, you know, my wife and I don't agree on religion, we don't agree on politics, but we're happy. We've been married together for all those times, we just don't agree on them. But they don't fight about them, they talk about them, but they just don't fight. They're a remarkable couple, absolutely remarkable to see them working together in such a fashion and communicating together. And to come into their home, it's such a welcome thing. And he's unabashedly expressive about the fact that they may not agree about a lot of things, but they made a commitment together, and in their intimacy, they share these deep thoughts of sharing their deep feelings. And it works because they discovered some law, whether they even looked in the Bible or not. Another thing, when you gain trust, each must be honest then to express feelings in a way that the other mate can understand. In other words, as it says in Ephesians 4 and verse 25, speak the truth. Now some people use that, and I was talking with a lady yesterday because she loves to pride herself on speaking the truth. The problem is her timing is awful. Timing is a factor in speaking truth. Because if you've come home, gentlemen, from a hard day's work, and the wife is haggard, maybe she's the one who keeps the home, or maybe she's been on her job and she's coming home and she's involved with the children and so forth, and she has, the flags are up. You see the flags, And you know it's been a tough day, and then you take the approach, well, what's wrong with you? You know, what's the problem here? Can't you manage the situation? Oh, that's a nice little button to push. You know, can't you handle this? Why are you so upset? What's bothering you? When you see all of the signs and all the flags, and the problem is that speaking truth requires discernment. It requires recognizing timing, and timing becomes very, very important. It says the reason that you speak truth is because we are members belonging to one another. And one of the points I try to make over and over again when I talk to the churches, and I know that there are married couples out there who both claim to be Christians, is that the closest neighbor you have, and the Bible talks a lot about neighbors, right, is your husband or your wife. But we don't think of them as neighbors. That's just my husband. That's just my wife. And they should be able to take anything I put dish out. But the Bible tells us that you speak truth because we are neighbors. We are members belonging one to another. And where can you express that better than in marriage? The belonging to one another. The neighborliness. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That is the playground of practicing that kind of principle. So in the midst of developing tools of communication, speaking truth is very, very important. Suppose a wife feels that she's not being heard before she speaks to her husband, because he may, in fact, have been beat up out there in the world, and that's what God says would happen. that was the curse that man was under. Apparently before, if he hadn't sinned, he wouldn't have been cursed out there being beat up in the world. But once the sin came in, now you got to go out there and fight the dragon. So a woman of discernment would understand, because Proverbs 17 and verse 27 says this: anyone holding back his sayings is possessed of knowledge. That is, you know something. You have something on your mind. There's something you want to express. But a person of discernment is cool of spirit. That is, they are in control. They figure out when to say. They figure out timing. They figure out how to present this. Many times words are spoken. Communication is involved. You're involved in communication, and hurt is the result, because I just got to get this said. And in fact, what you say may be true. Why don't you mow the lawn? It is up to the steps now. You know, you ought to mow the lawn. You claim to be a Christian. Look at how we are looking in the neighborhood. You know, those are words that hurt. It's true. But there's not discernment, you see. And there's not the timing. There's an idea that I've stood all I can stand and I can't stand some more, so I'm just going to cut your knees off. Cut you off right at the knees now. I'm going to really make you hurt by that kind of communication. When you express these kinds of feelings in the midst of frustration and anger, it generally does not tend to produce the results you want. It says then, in Proverbs 15 and verse 22, there is a frustrating of plans where there is no confidential talk. There is a frustrating of plans, dreams, goals, you know, future, when there is no confidential talk. The kind of intimate communing that goes on best in a marriage relationship. That indicates then you must talk. You must find a time and a place to talk about your confidential feelings. Your mate loves you, but that doesn't mean she or he can read your mind. So the sharing of those kinds of dreams requires a creativity. I'm sure that Mr. Gross is going to get in the romantic part of it, the kind of creativity that there may be something you want to talk about. Wives. Now, when was the last time you really dressed up just for him? Just for him. When you dress up for your bosses, you want to be looking good in the workplace, right? Because you want to communicate something in the workplace, right? But he comes home and what do you communicate when you're the hair's not together and things are not quite right, you know, occasionally that's going to work like that because you're involved in things, but that special occasion, because there's something you want to communicate. Maybe there's that special vacation you want to take. Maybe there's something you want to accomplish, and you're going to present it. It's all in the presentation sometimes. Remember the Cosby Show, the program that talked about presentation? When one of his daughters came home from school with this guy that she was going to marry, and the first time they heard about the marriage was there at the house when the couple was there, and he set them down, and he asked the gentleman, "Now, what's your favorite meal?" "Well, steak." "Oh, steak. You like steak, right? Oh, medium rare? Rare, how you like it?" He went on to describe it. "What else you'd like with it? Potatoes around and so forth, and onions, and maybe some mushrooms and so forth." And he described this meal, this fantastic meal. He said, "Now, what if I put all of that on the lid of a garbage can and presented it to you? You wouldn't like it, would you? Because it's all in the presentation. All in the presentation." So the communication factor then, in sharing what you really feel, those intimate thoughts, how are you going to present it? When are you going to present it? How are you going to wrap the package up? In the marital relationship, there are very few limitations on the kinds of things you might use. I'm sure that Eve made a presentation to Adam, which caused him to eat that fruit. You know? Because they didn't have any clothes on. Can we talk? Because, you see, sex is communication, isn't it? You're expressing something. You're trying to say something through it. Now, I am sure that she may have reminded him. It's not written in the scriptures. Just allow me a little license. That she must have said, "Adam, now I've tasted this fruit." Of course, the Bible says he wasn't deceived. And God gave him the original instruction, and God communicated to Adam about what he was supposed to do. Yet he made a choice not to do it, and he was then responsible to communicate it to his wife. Because God never told Eve about the trees. When you go back to the second chapter and follow the scenario, Adam was told after he had named the animals. Then Eve was created out of his side. And he was held responsible for the education of his family. He was supposed to communicate it, that intimate, that serious predicament. And if he didn't communicate it, it was his responsibility. And if he did and he stood by watching and allowed his wife to do what she did in that instance, because it was life-threatening, let's face it, God says you're going to die. And they died. The instant sin came in. Oh, they didn't lay down and stop breathing, but they died. They got out of covenant relationship with God. So communication is a very important thing, because today we would be here in the garden if Adam had done his job. But he didn't. In this seriousness of communicating, Adam should have said to his wife, "God says this, that, and the other thing," but she had the mojo working, as they say. Adam, they were created on the sixth day. Now, I'm sure that Adam, after watching all the animals parade around and naming them and so forth, and animals doing what they do, it may have been in his mind to do what husbands and wives do, and probably had tasted of connubial bliss, sex. Now, it was easy for her to say, and women all know this, and men know this too, that if a woman makes a nice presentation, the communication, and she wants something to happen, she knows the quickest way to his heart is not through his stomach. Am I getting through to everyone? Okay. So there was this tool that she had available, Adam. If you do not eat this fruit, you will not have any more fruit. You got the picture? Embarrassing anybody yet? But it's a part of communication. We all know that. We all understand that. We've all been there. And the use of that tool, then, it can be used as a weapon. The Bible condemns that, 1 Corinthians 7. condemning using sex as a weapon. So I'm having a little fun with the fact that Eve may have used it as a weapon against Adam, because she was communicating something to the detriment of that family, to the detriment of mankind. So you can use wrong tools and you can come up with the wrong results. But if you use it in the right way, the Bible does talk about using it in the right way, you come up with the right results. Now, in this communication scenario, on our outline, we have barriers of communication. Let's talk about some of that. And I think we've touched on it already in Paula's session, which helped us to identify the types of people we are. Because knowing that, you can eradicate those self-imposed barriers to communication. Once you know who you are, you know, what you're like and how you react to things. Most people never know these things. They don't know why they get angry. They don't know why certain buttons are pushed. They don't know that they're carrying, harboring stuff that happened even before they ever met the mate. They just kind of have it happen. And some of us are in that boat. Some of us have these self-imposed barriers because we have not had our personalities developed, nor have we examined them well enough to know how to even adjust ourselves. We usually resort to this attitude, that's just the way I am. This is the way I always react. This is how I handle it. But the Bible comes along and says, don't do that. Don't react the way you normally react. Change yourself with a little help. That's what Romans 12 is about. Being transformed by the renewing of your mind. It's not just how I relate to the person sitting in the next pew. It's also in that marital relationship that I must make this kind of change. The self-imposed barriers to communication. Anybody want to name any other kinds of imposed barriers that might come to mind? Self-imposed ones to communication? Besides, that's just the way I am? Yeah. Probably no esteem at all. How's that? The self-esteem term is currently popular, but let's just say no or little esteem. Oops. E-S-T, help me. E-S, two E's in there, okay. No or little esteem. What do we mean by that? Anybody want to help me with that? Hello? You're out there. I hear you breathing. No or little esteem. Okay. Don't have any value upon yourself. There's nothing that I do that is worth anything. Anything I say doesn't really amount to anything. It's not that significant. I mean, you've been places and you've done things. This may be the husband, it may be the wife who's expressing this, you know. And many people, when they are brought together in such a situation, what kind of person would that be, Paul? So we have the four types. Would that be the maybe the amiable or the, what was the first one? The expressive, or maybe one of those. Not the driver, you know, not the the analytical person, but maybe one of the others who kind of is laid back, really don't have anything to contribute. Oh, I don't have any talents. There's nothing that I could do. This is an impediment then to communication, because as soon as you start to talk, you're interrupted by the superior person, right? Because they really know. That's what I was watching in that couple. She would try to express something, boom, there he is. Probably runs an office. Maybe has his own business. This was out in the suburbs of Detroit where they had lots of money, you know. And he's a control freak, see. He's got it together. What are you talking about? I don't know what you mean. Why are you complaining? Why are you so upset? You got everything that's under the sun. You know, we've got the big screen TV. We got 2-3 cars in the garage. We go on trips. We got the time-sharing condo. We got this and that, and you're complaining? There are plenty of people. Oh, this is one of the things she said. Well, I think I can't take it anymore. We need to get a divorce. Fine, you go ahead. Just leave the kids because there's somebody to take your place. Was his approach. That wasn't communication. Oh, there were words going back and forth. And there was a certain level of communication, but it wasn't reaching into the heart of the matter because he wasn't listening. He wasn't seriously understanding. And she had little or no esteem, maybe some other impediments that had come through her life that made it impossible for her to reach into his heart and impossible for him then to allow the wall to come down to communicate effectively with his mate. Self-imposed. He was doing the manly thing. This is the way men are. Rambo would never have to consult with a wife. John Wayne hops on the horse and goes riding down the trail. I should say one of his characters, you know, the one who cast his personality, several failed marriages, but we won't talk about that with Mr. Wayne. These characters, you know, that we see around us who are so strong and can wipe out troops of people. You know, it's not a real world, but they can wipe them out. They can be cops, and they can just destroy all the enemy in the community and kill all the drug dealers and so forth. But the most you're going to get out of them is a yep and a nope, like Gary Cooper, you know. Yep, nope, that's it. No more communication than that. That self-imposed kind of barrier will destroy communication. The second thing is outside problems. What are some of the outside problems that prevent or destroy communication?
Job.
Well, school, I mean, that's like a job for some people. Okay, we'll go with the children, family. Family, okay. What else? We said children, okay, we'll assume that to be family too. Yeah?
By job, you mean bringing home
with your reason? This is the outside problems that impinge upon the communication relationship. So this is outside the home. Some people do work at home, I understand, but let's say just the job that earns the bread and earns a living that puts us out there with the dragons. Okay? Job, family, peer pressure. Let's call it that because generally friends are our peers. Child, I wouldn't take that. You know, you watch the Oprah show, let's put those down, talk shows. Because there's a lot of fecal detritus that come through those programs. Do you understand what I mean by fecal detritus? Well, okay. Because you have people up there regurgitating all over the public and advisors on how to do this. Now, sometimes there's some good stuff that comes through here, but you've got to be able to recognize it. There are sometimes that works. But generally, these are impediments. These are outside adjutants or agitations to communication. Here's how I think it ought to work. Oprah, for instance, doesn't believe that in child rearing, for instance, that you should ever strike a child because you teach them how to hit. You also teach them how to sit down and shut up and how to be obedient and in control.
Oprah don't go to the mall for
Oprah doesn't have any children. Let's put it like that because we can all pontificate about how it ought to be when you don't have them. But she is a victim or a product of a society that looks at things a certain way. And because of her personal experiences, this gets back to the self-imposed barriers to communication, the abuse that she experienced, et cetera, and many of these talk shows, hosts have all of these impediments that they bring with them. All of our peers look at it a certain way. Honey, child, why in the world are you still with that man? You've been wanting to go on a vacation. You've been wanting to that fur coat, and he's driving a sports car. Why can't you have what you want? Why, you're just as good as, you know, and the peers just go on and on. you have to eliminate these kinds of things in order to have intimate communication with the mate you've chosen for life. You can't allow that interference from those areas. When I say allow, each party must know that when you leave the job, you don't bring that negative stuff, the kind of negative stuff that clouds or confuses the situation in your life. Oh, you talk about it. That's part of the exchange of ideas, the intimacy that goes on. But you can't let that rule. You can't let that impose itself so strongly. Family, that's why the Bible talks about severance. Leaving father and mother. It's not their business anymore. You may counsel with them, but understand there's a limitation there. A very strong limitation on how much they're going to interfere. You're going to allow that interference because you are responsible now as a husband and wife. And other people, there's a proclivity with people, if they see that you're kind of happy, that's just painful. They can't have that go on. So let me just advise you, let's go out and have a drink so you can get unhappy like I am. And of course, the talk shows are an amazing phenomenon. Absolutely. They become so irritating, not all of the programs at all the times, but I mean, they get so irritating to me that my head starts to hurt. And I just want to grab a few of them and slam their heads down on the bar like I was talking about the other couple. Oh, sure, the greatest destroyer of communication is that thing they call the TV. Man, you can just click that on. And I basically am a TV junkie for some things, you know, especially sports. can I get a witness? there's a witness back there. I mean, but I have turned the corner. There are sometimes I don't even know what the score is or who's playing or care to. That's a change because there was a time before ESPN and all these cable things when I really, if it was on, I got to watch it. And so that will rob communication. That will destroy it every time. Now, if you can watch it together to discuss it, to have a form of foundation of talking about something, that's different. But that's not the only instigator of communication. Actually, maybe going to a museum. Taking a walk? A walk? How much does that cost? Now, let's go take a walk and we can talk about the feast plans. You know, of course, there's somebody who already has the feast plans planned. You know anybody? Anybody? I tried to figure it out, Paul, today, but I didn't know who you were talking about. You got to help me. Okay, Mr. Weary. Soap operas? Strong. Hear your question completely about soap operas now? A negative one, yes. Child, did you see the soap? Did you see what Mary Lou was going to do today? And the people, I mean, they had the scenario in the newspapers, they got columns to keep you updated in case you missed it. Stuff to talk about. You know, I wrote a paper working on a master's degree on soap operas and got an A on it because at the time I was kind of hooked on them. On soap operas. I got sick in California one time, was home with the flu for a week or so. Started watching, because that's what all was on. There was no cable in those days. Man, okay, let me just watch this. And then Dr. So-and-so did this, and Rachel said that, and Mac did this, and this, it just got kind of intriguing, you know? So I wrote this paper on popular culture, American popular culture, and at the time, there was a philosophy that this was the most real thing on television because the other shows were not that real about life. You know, everything's tied up in a neat package within an hour, but soap operas just goes on and on, kind of mirroring life. And many times, it's jumped way ahead of life and thereby influence how life ought to be. And that's part of what people wind up doing is duplicating the marital, let's call it, merry-go-round bed, you know, jumping back and forth around because there are no standards at all. Now, I think we all understand that communication is very essential to accomplishing what it is we want to do. I forgot what time we started. I know I'm going to overlap with the conflict resolution presentation that Larry is going to be providing. But I want to kind of leave you with some things from Chuck Swindoll's book, Strike the Original Match. That's a loaded title. Strike the Original Match. You know, he's not only talking about our individual marriages, but he's talking about going back to the garden. The original match between Adam and Eve. Because there were things, as Christ later says, were intended from the beginning that never materialized and never were realized. And furthermore, rekindling and preserving your marriage fire. And one of the areas that Chuck talks about deals with communication. And he titles the chapter, and I won't go into great detail about it because I'm going to leave something for Larry erstwhile he will want to speak to me about it, taking his material. But he entitles the chapter, How to Have a Good Fight. Now, that's a captivating title because he's inferring that people do fight, sometimes physically. That's not any of us here, but sometimes verbally. That is an exchange of ideas, a communication effort. But there are impediments then for that success. And so he describes how to have a good fight, and he gives us seven things that will help us have a good disagreement, if you prefer that term, or discussion, or an attempt at communication about something of importance within a relationship. If you turn to Ephesians, the fourth chapter, when he wrote to the Ephesian church, he had a lot of things in mind. 5:30, I think that'll be a good stopping point. I don't want to tire you out. It's been a long day. But he wrote some things that are applicable to the Christian in relationships in marriage and outside of marriage. But we are concerned with marriage. In Ephesians, the fourth chapter, verses, 25 through 32, those seven verses, are the ones that I want to use as the backdrop or the impetus to these points I want to give you on how to have this communication in a marital relationship and how you can improve the results. Ephesians 4 and verse 25 through 32 will be the guide to answering how can couples have a better flow of communication towards harmony. It offers seven rules for having a good fight. Seven rules of having a good fight. These rules will allow you to carry on normal, natural, disagreeable times without breaking with the Scriptures. Because the basis of communication for the Christian should be the Word of God. If Adam had realized that, things would have been far different. If he could have said to Eve, Eve, you've made a mistake. God says for us not to do this and do that. And he holds me responsible. You've made a mistake. I will speak to God for you. Because God's going to come and ask me about the situation since he holds me responsible. Now, that's not popular in a world where everybody's equal. We may be equal of physical composition, but we're not equal in position. That's important. That's why we have kids killing people out in the streets. Dad can't be found in his rightful position that God ordained in the garden. He's not there. And so mama can't deal with these kids. He's 14 or 15 and tells her, you're going to do what? I'm going out when I feel like it. And there's nobody around to check him. So what we're talking about when we're talking about striking the original match, going back to the garden the way God described it to be, where he indicated it should be, there's a lot more said than we have time to explore. But these rules that Paul discovered and wrote down for us are applicable to us if we would take heed. The first rule, this is beautiful, keep it honest in your communication. Now, keep it honest. I read you earlier about being truthful and so forth. Keep it honest. It says, be committed to honest and mutual respect. The way it reads in the scriptures, therefore, laying aside falsehood, speak with each one of you with his neighbor, for we are members of one another. Now, if let him acquire marriage, I don't know where it applies. Members of one another, two becoming one flesh, intimate relationship, that's the perfect place for it. But there's something more in that verse that one must be aware of, because in the Greek there's a sense or a tense issue. When one talks about being truthful or being committed to honesty, in the Greek there is a particular verb tense that conveys the idea of something being done in a point of time. In other words, when you are saying, I'm going to be honest, or I'm going to keep this honest, I'm going to be respectful, that's not something that you say every day. That's something that happens in a point in time, and from that time forward, that is the way it's going to be. It's not a reiteration all the time, you know, I'm really speaking to you honestly now, dear. You know, I'm not lying to you now. No. At a point in time, you determine I am going to speak and I'm going to keep it honest. If we're having this argument or this disagreement or this communication, I'm going to be honest. That's hard to do, isn't it? Because there are impediments to honesty. There's that self-preservation idea. Got to protect myself because I really don't trust that if I share this that it's going to go well. But the scriptures tell us in this passage that we're looking at to be honest. Swindoll says, I'm calling this a commitment because of the thought here of having already done something. There is something that you do day after day after day. This isn't something that you do day after day after day. Rather, as a husband or a wife to a husband, you commit yourself by saying, honey, no matter what, I want you to know that from this point and forever in our relationship, it is my deep desire to be honest with you and to respect you as a person. It is not something that is repeated in a half-hearted way time and time again through the marriage. This is just the way we're going to operate in our communication attempt. It is essential that you count yourself as commit yourself as to an honest relationship, ideally even before you marry, so that you do not fall into the trap of acting or lying to each other just to win that approval. You know how you used to do? The wife generally might like opera. Okay? Honey, I like to go see Carmen. He says, oh, you would? Really? This is when you're dating, of course. Good, I'll get the tickets. Let's go. Because I like it, too. What you like, I like. You know? Now, it could be Clint Black. It could be, you know, whatever it is that she likes. She presents the proposal. He says, yippee-yay, let's go. After they're married, she makes the same proposition. And he says, I don't like that. And her hair goes, what? You used to? This is the lying aspect. This is not telling the truth. This is not being honest. You see. Because now that you've got what you were after, the prize, you don't feel like you have to lie anymore. So now you're being honest, but it has caused some dissonance, some problems, because you haven't been truthful. He says to her, Honey, I'll be by about 3:30 in the morning, 3:30 a.m. We're going to go out there to the lake, and we're going to fish all day. And she says, I'll pack the lunch. Let's go. Before you're married. After you're married, he says the same thing, and she says, I hate fishing. Keep it honest. Very important. That's what the scripture says, you know, about telling the truth, one with another, right? Because it builds a relationship, it doesn't destroy, it doesn't have you having whiplash back and forth. What happened? You didn't used to say that. You didn't used to feel that way. Well, that's just the way I am now, and I'm the man, and therefore, you know, the way people are. Okay, we've got to hurry along. Next thing, keep it under control. Boy, it's easy to get out of control. Very easy to get it out of control. The next scripture talks about be angry and yet do not sin, verse 26. Be angry yet do not... How do you do that? Every one of us in this room know when we sin, when we're angry, don't we? We know when we have passed the line. We know because it's within us. It's that part of that intimacy that's in us. This gives us a green light to be angry. The Bible says that very clearly, you can be angry, but you can't sin in that anger. All of us know when our conscience, says Swindoll, when anger has become sin. I don't have to spell it out to you. Bursts of temper are sinful. Anger that slips out of control is sinful. Anger that plans to hurt another member of the family or another individual is sinful anger. Anger that is expressed in profanity is too. You know the point where your anger becomes sin. That's the point that Paul is describing. Be angry, but you got to have some control. You've got to control yourself if you're going to be able to communicate effectively about what it is that concerns you. Proverbs 18 and verse 14, we're going to have to turn to it, it just says, the spirit of a man can endure his sickness, but a broken spirit, who can bear? Once you break a spirit, or crush a spirit, boy, it's hard to refabricate that, to build it up. But sometimes when we're trying to attempt to communicate, we say things that we wish we could put back in there, but they're out there, they're rattling around, they're stabbing, and they're dividing asunder, and they're doing their job. But it's kind of late, and trying to recapture it is very difficult. Have you ever been wounded or crushed by your mate? Don't raise any hands. I'm sure that we all have had times, angry words said in the spur of a moment are deadly weapons. When we attack the person rather than the problem, we move into deadly areas. When we make things personal or assault motives rather than dealing with the wrong situation, we're treading on thin ice. Somebody asked me earlier today about ice fishing. I always think of it as thin ice, so I've never thought about going ice fishing up in Michigan where I lived up there, because I don't want to get out on thin ice. But in relationships, we tread on thin ice all the time. You know, thinking we will never fall through. And the encouragement here is being under control. Keep our communication under control so that we do not allow anger to fall over into the area of sin. That Mr. Watkins is going to talk about tomorrow, on how to resolve conflict if where you don't move into the venture of sin. Keep it timed right. I talked earlier about timing. Oops. The wrong time to talk about kinds of things that are intimate and resolution-oriented is not when you walk in and the dishes are piled high, or let's say after dinner, and the dishes are piled high, kids need to be put away, and you want to talk, gentlemen. Wrong time. Wrong time if you've got children yet at home. Timing is all wrong. You have to be wise enough to understand that maybe you could say, let me help you with that. I'll do the dishes and you take care of the kids. Now, me standing here saying that, and I just go back and I can wander back in my mind and sitting there flicking, well, I didn't have a remote control. I had to get up and change the station. That was about the most I could do was to get up and change the station while chaos is reigning around. You know, the children need to be put to bed and dishes need to be washed, and Myra was back there smiling because that's the way it was. Sabbath rolls around. Well, got to go to church, especially when we had two children, you know. I'm going to watch the news. I need to be up on the news so that when I get to services, I can talk about these things with people, you know, what's happening in the news. So who got the kids ready? You know, that's communication. And over time, that communicates more than you intended that it communicate, you see. But timing things is very, very important when you want to talk about deep, intimate things. And you want to consider when is the proper time to deal with it. I write so slow, I'm going to give you these and be able to wrap up here very quickly. Keeping time, things timed right deals with the verse that says, "Do not let the sun go down on your anger, and do not give the devil an opportunity," because he's standing around watching all the time, looking for an opening. When we don't do it right, he's there to drop a little salvo. When Adam wandered off, there was Satan with Eve. "What's up, Eve? What time is it?" Now, did God say, you know, there he goes? Because Adam was not where he belonged. His timing was very bad. And then once he was able to recapture the situation, he still didn't carry out his responsibility. Another story. Fourth point. Keep it positive. Deals with verse 28. Rather than let, this particular one, number four, deals, in the passage you're reading, has to do with stealing. But if we apply the principle, Paul was addressing this thing about stealing, when you keep things positive, if you take a swing, a verbal swing, in this midst of communication, you know, take the swing, but you gotta have something positive to go with it. "I don't like the dinner at 8 o'clock in the evening. I'd like to have it at 6 or whatever it is." No, that is the positive question. You're going to have an alternate thing. You're going to have a proposal. A counter-proposal is the idea in keeping it positive. When you come to your mate with a justified criticism, be quick with a suggested solution. This is something we learned in Ambassador College, in Spokesman's Clubs and Ambassador Clubs. If you want to evaluate somebody in a speech, don't get up there and rake them over the coals. I mean, just rip them up and down and down the other side, and don't have anything positive to say. That was one of the things we learned that is necessary in order to have the negative part palatable or accepted. And it works very much like that in our relationships. Criticism hurt. A positive, supportive comment will help take some of the sting out of the wound. I know that a wife is very good, especially to us preachers. They're our best evaluators, really, when they get to know us, you know, if they venture out and want to see if the dragon can take it. Sometimes they will tell us something constructive, and many times they find the right time to say it, but they will give us some negative feedback so that we can profit thereby. And they know how to dress it up. They know how to say it and when to say it. That's a skill that's required in us in our relationships. Remember, condemnation without hope crushes. Male or female, condemnation, you know, "I don't like what you're doing." So, what's the solution? You have a recommendation? You have an alternative plan? Fifth thing, keep it tactful. Very, very important. "Let no unwholesome word proceed from your mouth," verse 29. Unwholesome means something that is rotten or putrid, just disgusting. But then to be gracious and to have a principle of tactfulness involved with you. "But only such a word as is good for edification, according to the need of the moment, that it may give grace to those who hear." With our children, that should be the way it is. With each other, that is how we should do it, with tact. And verse 30 talks about not grieving the Holy Spirit. Number 5, when we talk about being tactful and God is watching what we do and he's given his Spirit to exercise what we're going to do in our communication, we mustn't grieve the Holy Spirit from doing its job. for guiding us and letting us do the right thing. Sixth thing, keep it private. Boy, this is a good one. I think I better do this one. Keep it private. Don't swing at your mate in public. I'm not talking about physically. I'm talking about verbally. Man, I could keep some of those words back. There are two ways we do this. Open, bold embarrassment, or just cutting sarcasm. Anybody here sarcastic? Anybody sarcastic stand? Oh. I mean, oh. Yeah, those things hurt. They really hurt. Swindoll talks about an example. I'll paraphrase it. He had finished his preaching a strong sermon on family. He was out in the vestibule, 50 people gathered around. This man comes up to him just crestfallen because the sermon had penetrated into his heart and realized he had made some mistakes in his marriage and so forth. And he was explaining all that to Pastor Swindoll. And toward the end of his statement, his wife walked up and all she heard was, "Our home is a wreck." She got in on the end of what he was saying, of his confession and so forth. And when she heard "our home's a wreck," she just read the riot act out there in the vestibule where all these people could hear as she was reading him royal. She didn't hear all of it, but she embarrassed him in the public out there when she didn't have to do it because she really didn't have all the facts. And, of course, being sarcastic with her comments as well. Those things really hurt. An attempt sometimes at humor, I didn't ask my if I could share this with you, but there was a situation I did one time in Ambassador College. I don't know if we've been married 2 years or probably somewhere in there, but they had a sing-along at the college out in Pasadena. And I'd been asked to sing a song, and then, of course, Mr. Armstrong and Mr. Portune, different ones, had done the sing-along, and so it was a break time, and then I came up to do this solo. And I won't go into the details of what I sang, but it was, in an attempt at humor, I used something inappropriate. And I didn't realize it until recently just how bad it was. A bad choice, a bad decision in a public circumstance because it was embarrassing to my mate when I didn't intend it to be, but I didn't think about it. And many times we get our mouths going before we think about it in public circumstances, like at dinner tonight. I know we're all going to be on guard tonight. You're not going to say much of anything. You're just going to feed your face because that way you won't embarrass your mate. But there tends to be a time when you feel a little freer to say some things maybe that should be private, that maybe should be talked about, or you use it as an opportunity to jab one another, you know, to job one another, to kind of give the old needle, because maybe if I give you the needle in public, you'll change in private. Not. It doesn't work that way. It just gets deeper and retrenched or entrenched when we don't keep matters of our hearts and our intimacy private. Very important. Then the final one is to keep it cleaned up. The seventh rule. When it's all over, help clean up the mess. Verse 32 says, "And be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving each other, just as God in Christ also has forgiven you." Kindness, tenderness, forgiveness. At the heart of the word kind is grace. Be gracious enough to wipe it off the mental slate. You know, harboring things that may have been done and may have been said, when you're going to create this environment of communication to clear it up, is not godly. It is not what the Scriptures encourages us to do. At the heart of tenderness, then, is compassion, the kind that Christ displayed, that he was able to be compassionate to those people who he knew needed help. Being compassionate enough to weep with the ones who hurt from the disagreement or the problems that exist. And at the heart of forgiveness is the very person of Jesus Christ who forgave us. So when we have tenderness and kindness and forgiveness in this area of the seventh area of keeping things cleaned up, we're always referring back to the fact that our marital relationship is an image of Christ and the church. It's what Paul talked about later in the fifth chapter of this book of Ephesians. He talked all about marriage and how it should work and how what the husband is supposed to do, what the children are supposed to do, what the wife is supposed to do, all in the context. I speak a mystery, he says. A mystery. And we've been allowed to peep into the mystery of Christ and the church. And if we truly look at that mystery and implement this skill, or this quality of communicating on a level so intimate and so deep, we will strengthen our marriages, and the church will benefit because it's supposed to. Our children will benefit. Everything ripples out from this. So what we're doing here is not a light thing. I compliment Larry and Paula for pulling these things together, because we've needed it for some time, and I hope that this is not the last one we'll do, because there's so much. I mean, communication, I've learned a lot about it. I think I'd like to share a lot with you, but I've got to stop.